think Bitcoin actually changes the dynamic of preserving wealth dramatically, right? Before, with all these families, they needed to figure out a way, whether it was maintaining the business or what they're investing all of the, this excess cash in. But Bitcoin completely changes it, right? It's finite. So if it's in Bitcoin, just leave it in Bitcoin. You don't need to buy, sell, you know, move it around. It's there, just leave it. And so I think we might actually see, maybe not in our lifetimes, but, you know, generations to come, you know, somebody that bought Bitcoin today, it's in the family, it stayed in the family for three generations, and the wealth is still there. So many people online are vanilla. They're afraid to say what they actually think. And I've fallen into that category so many times of like, oh, I don't want to step on anybody's toes. I don't want to say what I actually think. But then that's boring, you know, and you'll never find your tribe that way. But there is something to be said of like, just disregard what other people think and just say and do what it is that you actually want to do. The Bitcoin community often has an added level of skepticism, which I think serves it well. Sometimes I'm sure it doesn't, but somebody in the room has to, you know, be asking these larger questions of, you know, why is he doing this? Why is this happening? And so I think that's important. You know, I was not easily convinced about the Bitcoin route, but, you know, once I got into it, you know, it's a rabbit hole that, you know, you can't really get out of.
If you enjoy this podcast and you want to learn more about Bitcoin, then make sure to subscribe to our free newsletter. Every Friday, we send out insights into macro, Bitcoin on-chain, and Bitcoin mining. Join over 100,000 existing subscribers by clicking the link in the description or going to newsletter.blockwareintelligence.com. This video is sponsored by Stampseed. You plan on holding your Bitcoin for decades, so you need to make sure that your seed phrase is documented in something that can last just as long. Stampseed's signature titanium plates and stamping kits do just that. If you simply write your Bitcoin seed phrase down on a piece of paper, it's vulnerable to fire, water, and all sorts of erosion that can happen over time. Make sure you keep it secure for years to come. Head to Stampseed.com and use the code BLOCKWARE15 for 15% off the entire website. You wouldn't walk down the street with a giant sign that has your home address on it. So why would you do the same on the internet? You need to use a VPN. Orca VPN is a service that encrypts your internet connection and hides your IP address, ensuring your online activities are private and secure. Orca VPN works on all different devices, Windows, Mac, iOS, Android, and Linux. Head to orcavpn.co and use the code BLOCKWARE, and you can access Orca VPN for just $1.99 a month. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can ensure that all your internet activity is private and secure. Again, that's orcavpn.co, orcavpn.co. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the BlockWare podcast. This week, I'm proud to welcome Meet Matt L. from Twitter. And Matt, I'll let you introduce yourself. Normally, I introduce the guests, but to be honest, we've been following each other on Twitter for a while. I've had some back and forths, but honestly, I have no idea how we got intermingled there. We don't have a lot of like audience crossover. So who are you and what do you do?
Absolutely. Well, first off, thanks for inviting me. Like you said, you know, we've chatted a little bit back and forth on Twitter, and that's been great. I started going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, you know, 6 months or so ago, and I found your content. So I've been learning a lot. But to back up, yeah, we don't have a ton of overlap in terms of our audiences. I feel like I do mostly only one thing, and that is build LARC funding, which we'll talk about. But I have a lot of different interests, especially Bitcoin being one of them. So it was definitely great to connect. But if you want, I can kind of start with, you know, how my journey began, and we can kind of build up from there. Yeah, so I started like most people around 16, 17 years old. You know, I was in school, didn't know what I wanted to do. And a buddy of mine, one of my classes was trading, and I was looking at the charts. I was like, dude, are you making any money? That he was trading Forex. I heard about it. He was like, yeah, I turned like $1,000 into $10,000. Dude, like at 17, 10K, I was like, man, that's insane. Like, you know, it's more money than I don't even know what to do with. I didn't believe him. He opened up his laptop and he showed me the 10K. And from that second, I was completely hooked. And that kind of started my trading journey from 17 all the way up to today. But for anybody watching, you as well, you know, if you've tried trading, day trading, if you don't have a lot of money, you can't really make anything. You know, if you have $1,000, even if you make 10%, you know, you beat the S&P 500, congrats, you got $100 in your pocket. You know, it's not going to take you very far. And so, for me, when I started trading, that was the huge bottleneck. I was working minimum wage. I was trying to fund this personal account, but the growth was so slow. And so fast forward a few years, you know, I spent all this money on courses, blew multiple accounts. It just wasn't working. But then I found this company called FTMO. This was in 2020. And they kind of completely changed the game, not just for me, but for a bunch of traders. So what they allowed you to do is you sign up, you pay a fee, and take an evaluation, take a challenge with them, which says you have to make X percent, usually 10% in 30 days. You can't lose 5% in a day. You can't lose 10%. Whatever the rules are, they vary a bit. But if you can hit these criteria, they will then give you a funded account and you can keep 75 to 90% of your profit. So, you know, you could sign up for a $100,000 account for $500. You pass it, you get to keep 75, 80% of the profits. And so for me, this completely changed the game because instead of trying to flip accounts, I could drop $500, pass this, and make some money with it. So I did that in 2020. I passed a bunch of these challenges and I started making enough money to quit my job. By no means, I was not buying, you know, a Lambo, any of that fancy stuff, but you know, my living expenses were low. So I quit my job, did it full time. And I did that for 2 years before starting Lark Funding, which is now a competitor to FTMO.
Dude, that's really interesting. So if you, let's say you win that challenge, right? Do they, and you start trading and you're making losses, then you just like lose the funded account basically?
Exactly. Yeah. So you lose the funded account, but your downside is completely limited, right? You only, let's say you fail the account, you lose it, then you only lost the deposit that you made. So if it's a 100K account, roughly $500, but you can buy smaller ones too. You know, you could get a 10K account for, you know, $100, $50, whatever it is. So your upside is technically unlimited, but your downside is capped.
That's interesting. And I think I speak for a lot of my audience when we get into Bitcoin, it's because we see like trading is one of the first things you see because Bitcoin's such a volatile asset. You're like, oh, I want to trade this thing now. Bitcoin is more of a buy and hold is my point of view. But what would you say a lot of people get wrong with trading? Because personally, it's something I would do and I'm interested in. But every time I've tried, I've gotten wrecked. Like, so I realize I'm going to leave that to the experts. So what do a lot of people get wrong with that?
I think a lot of people go into trading with just completely wrong expectations. It's so easy to, you know, drink the Kool-Aid from all these influencers online, these YouTubers saying, you know, look at me, it's so easy, you know, with just $1,000, you can make, you know, millions of dollars. That's not the case. You know, I get, you know, quite a bit of flack on Twitter, even nowadays when I say, listen, trading a $1,000 account is pointless. You know, to flip it to 100K, you got to make something like 10,000%. You know, the top three hedge funds in the world over the last 3 years with over $1 billion in assets, they've returned, it was like 50% year over year for the last 3 years, right? So even if you can do that, you know, the best hedge funds with the best, the smartest guys out there, the best technology, you know, it's not going to happen. So I think it's those expectations that just aren't realistic. And listen, there's a difference between trading and gambling. If you want to enter it and say, you know what, instead of going to the casino, I'm going to drop $500 on this account. You know, I'm going to not be very risk managed, more power to you. But not a lot of people say, you know what, I'm just trying to make a quick buck. Most people say, you know, I want to do it long term, but they don't go in with those right expectations.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I know a lot of my audience trying to speak on their behalf, they would say that there's no delineation between trading and gambling. So how would you distinguish there? Because especially what I've noticed as sort of the fiat monetary system crumbles, which we can get into later, it seems that a lot of things have been very like hyper-financialized. Like everybody's trying to beat inflation. Like I need to make money any way possible. You had this whole, you know, GameStop phenomenon with that, with Wall Street Bets, and you've got like 0 day to expiry options. So there's a lot of products out there like that. How would you distinguish trading versus gambling?
Well, I think in a sense, they are very similar, right? You're taking a risk. You have no idea of what's going to happen, but there are professional gamblers out there like poker players that, you know, they have a large enough amount of money under them for a cushion and they know that their edge will play out. And I think from my experience, that's why 90% of traders don't make money. It's because it's so emotional that they don't allow their edge to play out. So to answer your question, I would say, you know, the difference would be if you have an edge. So let's say, for example, as a trader, you've backtested, you have experience, you know, 60% of your trades are going to be winners, 40% will be losers, and your average win will be, say, twice as large as your average loss. Well, if you run these stats through, you know, an equity curve simulator, you know, the likelihood of you having 8, 10, 12 losses in a row it's completely normal. That's going to happen. But after two or three traders, you know, they get emotional. They say, oh, my strategy sucks. I need to change it. And they never let their edge play out over time because they don't have a large enough sample size. So for me, what made a huge difference was instead of focusing on the next trade, you know, focus on the next 100. Have a large enough sample size to let your edge play out. For me, that's what made the biggest difference.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I try to think about it the few times I've sports gambled. It's better, you know, pick a whole slate of NFL games on a Sunday instead of just right. putting all your eggs into one game.
Totally. Yeah, because nobody, you know, all of these things, sports betting, trading, whatever it is, you have no idea what's going to happen, right? So put all your eggs in one basket on one bet that's completely outside of your control. It's not going to work long term.
Yeah, totally. As a trader, how much are you looking at sort of the broader macro picture, you know, following Fed meetings and like watching the reverse repo market and the bond market and all this stuff?
Yeah. So for me, part of why I got into trading was because I'm super interested in, you know, the macroeconomic environment, economics as a whole, the monetary system. I guess that's why, you know, I was not easily convinced about the Bitcoin route, but, you know, once I got into it, you know, it's a rabbit hole that, you know, you can't really get out of. So for traders, it really depends because you'll have scalpers, which will enter the market and exit, you know, within a couple of seconds or a couple of minutes. They're looking for really small movements. Then you'll have intraday traders that, you know, will hold a position for a couple of hours. Then you'll have swing traders that could hold for days to weeks to even months. And so for me, I found the sweet spot to be kind of intraday trading, you know, holding for a few hours. And so I did look at those things, those high impact news events. For traders, it's typically, you know, interest rate decisions, unemployment, and nowadays inflation. You know, when I first started 2017, 2018, inflation didn't move the market. It was always, you know, 2% under, it was a non-event. But nowadays, you know, as we all know, it'll massively shake the market. So it really depends for traders. You know, if you're trading those really small movements, you know, the larger picture economic environment doesn't matter. But if you're looking for those big swings, I don't see how you could possibly say, you know what, over the next 2 weeks, I'm going to buy gold, I'm going to sell gold without knowing what's actually going on in the world.
Right. That makes sense. And I imagine over the last couple of years, as Bitcoin and then just other cryptos have taken off, does that take up a lot of like your trading portfolio? Because it trades 24/7, right? So I imagine that, you know, you're not stuck to the 9-to-5 window anymore.
Well, there's definitely a dichotomy in my approach, you know, coming from a trading background to getting into Bitcoin. You know, I totally agree. You should buy Bitcoin and hold it and don't touch it. Don't sell it. You know, don't trade it. But the volatility for traders does offer an interesting opportunity. So I personally won't trade Bitcoin, but some of the clients that we have, some of the traders that we have at Lark Funding, you know, it's one of the few assets, like you said, that they can trade over weekends. And so, you know, traders, it kind of, a lot of times they're like drug addicts. You know, you're so invested in the market, you just want to get into a trade. And so we will actually see a lot of traders, you know, try and take advantage of weekend movements. From my experience, you'd know better than me, I don't think Bitcoin tends to move a ton over the weekends unless there's some kind of major news event, but they'll still try and take advantage of, you know, small movements.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's been a few, like Sunday nights tend to be like a time where it's exciting, but generally speaking, like after close on Friday and through Saturday, there's never really too much action.
It's pretty quiet. Now, yeah.
Yeah. Let's dive into Lark Funding. Was there a specific problem you saw in the trading world that you wanted to fix? And what's sort of the origin story and where are you at today with it?
Yeah, so I started the company in June of 2022. So it was right around the 2 year mark of trading full time. And there was really two problems that I wanted to solve with it. At the time, the largest companies in the industry, like FTMO, who I worked with, they had time limits on their evaluations. And for me, it just didn't make sense because if they're saying, we want traders to be risk managed, we want them to be disciplined, take their time. Well, if the S&P 500 or hedge funds only return, you know, 8 to 10% a year, why are you requiring traders to make 10% in 30 days? And for me, it didn't make sense because it forced you to over-risk. It forced you to not be risk managed. And so that was the first problem that I wanted to solve. And the second one was just poor customer service. FTMO, I'm not saying they have bad customer service. They were great with me. But I felt like there was a hole in the market in terms of a firm that wasn't huge, that wasn't doing hundreds of millions of dollars a year, And so as a result, could offer better trader support. You know, even to this day, you know, I'm still one of the main people that will answer emails. I like staying in touch with traders and clients and knowing what's kind of going down, you know, on the ground, boots on the ground, so to speak. So those were really the two main things that I wanted to solve for Lark Funding. And fortunately, nowadays, there's really not any company that is now having those 30-day time limits. So, you know, we weren't the only ones to do it, but slowly, because it's a new industry, that change did happen across the board.
Right. That makes sense. It was incentivizing short-term thinking, which is something with Bitcoin, it basically does the opposite. It incentivizes long-term thinking. If you approach it, you know, what's Bitcoin going to do today or tomorrow? You're probably going to get burned. But if you approach it, you know, 5-10 years, it's going to work out much better.
100%. Absolutely. Yeah. And so I started just to back up. So I started, you know, when I was trading full time on my own, I started my own YouTube channel, Meet Matt L. And so I was just sharing my own trading experience. And so I wanted to take a different approach than most trading influencers. You know, I always said, listen, I am not, you know, by any means the best trader out there. I always said, you know, I'm like a 4 out of 10, right? So if you're at level 2 or level 3, I can help you. If you're at level 5, you know, I'm not your guy. And so I just shared videos of what I did to, you know, quit my job to get funded with these companies. And it grew a very loyal audience. I feel like traders, you know, Bitcoiners as well, they're very loyal, which is fantastic. So I think when I launched the company, I only had, you know, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 subscribers, but they were loyal. You know, a lot of them were reaching out to me. We were chatting, you know, making connections. And so I kind of launched the company off of that channel.
Yeah, that's cool. My audience is pretty like similar, like very tight knit. I feel like, you know, quality over quantity at a certain point. And I'm glad you brought up your YouTube channel, because it is something I really enjoyed. Like, you make very, very high quality videos. I know there's this kind of stigma with like traders, like the mouth open thumbnails and just like a bunch of noise, but your videos are pure signal. And I kind of want to go through some of these, starting with, you have one titled "Why the Collapse of the US Dollar is Coming." So why is the collapse of the US dollar coming?
So this video I made after completely binging Balaji's podcast at the time. This was when, you know, SBJ was collapsing, and this was really the start of my Bitcoin journey, when, you know, Balaji was saying, get to the lifeboat. If Bitcoin, you got 90 days. You know, I was just devouring everything he was saying. I was honestly pretty nervous. You know, he said that, you know, my opinion is his direction, of course, is right. It was just the timing that's off. And he himself said that. So, you know, in terms of why it's collapsing, you would know better than I do. But, you know, the monetary system in terms of printing money has just been absolutely insane. I think, you know, the money supply has increased by 50% or so over just the last couple of years. Totally insane. And that video went into, you know, SBJ and how these banks, which even today, not many people are talking about it, they're holding unrealized losses in the realm of, what is it, $1 trillion?
Yeah, it's something insane. And they're still drawing from that BTFP program. It's wild.
It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. So the video went into that. So I can't speak in terms of, you know, super specifics, but it looked at SBJ, the banking situation as a whole. As we've all known, you know, since COVID, you know, every program that came out that just printed money, inflation has been astronomical. And it's, of course, way higher than the CPI says. You know, it's a completely skewed figure. So that's really what started my Bitcoin journey. And to speak about the YouTube channel, you know, it's good to hear that you like the videos, because, as I said earlier, there's kind of this dichotomy between, you know, the business and, you know, what I'm interested in, right? So while I'm not trading that often now, you know, I'm investing long term. And so that's why I actually moved all trading related videos to the Lark Funding YouTube channel. And now I'm just making videos on topics that I'm interested, like, you know, the SVJ collapse.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
SVB, right?
SVB. Yeah. Silicon Valley Bank. Yeah. So that's interesting that Balaji's bit signal is sort of what got your attention. I remember a lot of people were giving him crap, like, oh, 90 days, like, you're going to cause people to just like do extreme risk and like lose everything. And at the time I was like, no, this is, I don't think he obviously means Bitcoin's going to be $1 million in 90 days, but it's the flamboyancy of it to get people's attention. Like, sure, this collapse of the banking system won't take 90 days, but 90 months, it could. 90 right. years, definitely.
And he burnt $1 million of his own money to put out that signal, which, I mean, hats off to him. That's crazy.
Yeah, he's exactly. He was, you know, putting his money where his mouth is effectively. And that's cool that that's what brought you in and got your attention. I'm glad to hear that. I'm sure
what if Biology started... saw this.
Yeah. So similar,
yeah, I'd love to hear,
just
yeah.
without the banking collapse, it was 2020 when they expanded the money supply significantly. And I had done a little, like I'd listened to some economics videos, like more like classical guys like Thomas Sowell, not necessarily like Austrians yet. But I knew that you couldn't just increase the money supply by as much as they did and not get inflation. So one thing led to another. And I realized Bitcoin doesn't have that problem. Nobody can control it. Nobody can create more than 21 million. And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the rabbit hole does not end. And once you're in it, there's no turning back.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the more you learn about it, the more interesting it is. And it's hard. Once you see the value that it offers, you can't look away.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of funny because you're like into the trading world. And that was something that I initially like was appealed by Bitcoin for that reason. But then once I really learned it, I'm like, okay, I don't have to like become a full-time trader in order to make money to beat inflation. Like I could pretty reliably just buy and hold Bitcoin. And I know over the next decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, because I'm only in my early 20s, right? I have a whole lifetime to hold Bitcoin and basically don't have to worry about anything. And I think a lot of the issues with fiat is people are forced to trade and sort of take risk because you can't 100%. Just save and leave money in a bank account.
Yeah, that's a really great point. Yeah, you're forced to do something just to maintain the status quo, right? If you're losing 5%, 10% of your purchasing power every year, you can't sit on the sidelines. You know, you have to take riskier bets, whether that's investing in the stock market, trading, whatever it is, or you're just going to be more poor than you were, you know, at the beginning of the year, which is just, it's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. You know, we're being penalized for literally doing absolutely nothing. So,
yeah, it's ridiculous. And on your YouTube channel, you made another video. It was one of your, I think, most viewed, or maybe it's one of your earlier videos. I can't remember, but it's about Anthony Pompliano. And part of it, and my audience would be familiar with him. Maybe they're not all fans or whatever, but he's in Bitcoin and he has a really big YouTube channel. And in that video, you mentioned, you know, attention in the, like this economy is sort of like oil. Is that part of why you're building your YouTube channel? Do you see it providing value as far as growing Lark funding?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when I started to shift my YouTube channel from trading videos to topics that I'm more interested in myself, you know, it was a difficult decision and I'm still trying to figure out what my specific niche is. But I think it was Alex Hormozi who said, you know, your niche is who you are. You know, if you just make content on what you're interested in, sure, it might be a little bit broad, but nobody will be able to replicate what it is that you're interested in. And so that's kind of the direction that I'm going in. You know, if there's something that I'm interested in and after a bit of research, I can see, well, the market is also interested in it. You know, there's views on other videos that are similar, then I'll make a video on it. So to speak on Pomp, I made that video shortly after the Bology video, because again, Pomp is well known in the Bitcoin space. And yeah, absolutely. I think that nowadays, you know, our attention is pulled in so many places. You know, TikTok, for example, it is, you know, digital crack. You know, you can't get off of it. It is so addicting. All social media, it's so addicting. And so I think that it's definitely a missed opportunity to not be creating content online. It's not easy by any means, but I think the leverage that it offers long term, if you're willing to do it, you know, 10 years, 5 years, you know, twice a week, then I think it can absolutely change your life. And I'm living testament to that. You know, with just, you know, 6,000, 8,000 subscribers, I was able to launch a company without any paid ads whatsoever. And, you know, it keeps the roof over my head. So I definitely think there's value in doing it.
I 100% agree. A lot of these platforms are designed to get you on it and keep you on it. The algorithms, they work, right? If I go on YouTube and I go to the homepage, I know I'm going to see a video that is going to make me want to click and watch and waste time. So I'm of the same mindset as you. I want to be on the producing side of that rather than the consuming side. And I think something 100%. Also people forget about, it's kind of the same lines. People think they're not early to Bitcoin anymore when they are. People think it's too late to create content on the internet, but you got to understand, you know, all the kids being born today, they're going to be like native internet consumers, right? They're not going to be watching cable television. We still have a large majority of the population, which is like baby boomers, Gen X or whatever, that the internet isn't their primary method of entertainment, but that's changing slowly. The demographics are shifting. There's going to be a, you know, what is it? Probably 4 billion people use the internet today. That number could be, you know, 10, 20 billion, depending on how population grows over our lifetime.
Absolutely. And in terms of your Twitter account and you posting content online, I'd be curious to hear what's your goal with it. What's your goal with your Twitter account, which is great, by the way. Again, like I said, you know, I only understand like 50% of the content that you post. So I'm always learning a ton. You know, I really have to zoom in on the graphs that you're posting and really figure out what's going on. So that's great. But yeah, so your Twitter, and also be curious to hear, have you ever considered starting a YouTube channel? Is that something that you would do?
Yeah. So my goal with the Twitter is basically to just document my learning in public. And if I get something wrong and people roast me in the comments, it is what it is. I find that for me, I don't learn unless I either write about it or make some form of content that really solidifies the knowledge. And then, you know, growing a following or whatever, even though I don't have that many followers, that's an asset in itself, right? So that's something, not that I would want to like monetize necessarily, but for building community, right? So I've been able to connect with a lot of people and make a lot of like really good friendships via Twitter. And I think as my account grows, that'll become more and more the case. And as far as YouTube, so actually I've basically taken over the channel that this podcast could be on for my company Blockware. And I've really hammered down on YouTube. So I think, you know, the podcast is another way to sort of grow my presence online. I think it's foolish in 2023 if you're not trying to build an internet presence in some capacity. And I think it has to be authentic though, right? You can't just post about something you're not interested in. Like, I'm genuinely interested in Bitcoin, and it's hard to find people in real life to have these conversations with and really dissect, you know, what's going on in the Bitcoin market. What is the long-term outlook? You know, what's going on in the economy? So the internet really is the only way to do that. And, you know, the larger of a presence I can grow on the internet, the more interesting people I can talk to and the more I can learn. So really, fundamentally for me, it all boils down to wanting to learn.
Totally. Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, if you're doing something that's not authentic, people are going to be able to see right through it, first of all. And second, you're not going to have the motivation to stick with it. You know, you can make some video or replicate some video that went viral online. But if you're not interested in it, okay, you can pump up that one video. But these guys that are actually passionate about it, they're going to be doing it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. You'll never be able to compete with that. So yeah, you have to be authentic. And also, I think there's something to be said about, you know, the quality of your audience versus the size of it, right? If you have 1 million subscribers, but they're not necessarily of quality, meaning, you know, you're not building those connections, or, you know, you're not really providing specific value to them so that you can, you know, then maybe monetize that audience in some form or another. You know, there's something to be said about, you know, maybe 10,000 subscribers sometimes is better than 100,000 subscribers.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And that's really what I've tried to do. I'll often tweet out like sort of like hyperbolic statements just to like clear out some people who may not like, I want high quality followers. I want to provide signal to my audience and really provide value. I don't want to be just another one of these accounts that just is just like noise and like, yeah, not really providing anything of worth.
And I want to mention that because you post content that like is controversial sometimes. You know, you'll say stuff like, which I so respect. You know, I've said in multiple videos that, you know, so many people online are vanilla. They're afraid to say what they actually think. And I've fallen into that category so many times of like, oh, I don't want to step on anybody's toes. I don't want to say what I actually think. But then that's boring, you know, and you'll never find your tribe that way. So I'd be curious to hear, has that always been your approach? And how do you handle the negative comments that I'm sure you get when you post these controversial things?
Yeah, for sure. So the negative comments, I've become pretty liberal with the mute and block button, maybe almost to a fault, but I usually tend to ignore them. And you'd actually be surprised. A lot of the feedback I get is positive. And I think because like seemingly controversial statements, people just, they want authenticity, right? And a lot of the times it's something that people are saying or thinking, but they're like too afraid to say. And growing up, I was always kind of like that. I would say, you know, I would point out the elephant in the room type of thing. And, you know, as I got older, people are like, oh, you really should do that because you're not going to, you know, you're not going to be able to get a job if you say such and such things. And I'm like, well, I don't really care. I don't want to work for someone that's going to like do that to me anyways. Like, I want to be able to speak my mind. And I think there's two really valuable points is like, one, it like feels right on my conscience, right? I'm not hiding like who I truly am, like what I actually think, I'm sharing it. And then two, I think it provides
value in, right? People want, they don't want like watered down opinions. They can tell when you're like not actually speaking your mind. So I think both of those elements are very key.
Yeah, 100%. Like I mentioned earlier, when I'll put out tweets saying, you know, you're not going to turn your $1,000 trading account into $100,000. You know, people went off. They were like, how dare you? You know, this guy did it, that guy did it. And, you know, it'll get 400 likes and 80 comments. You'll scroll through the comments and they're all negative, but you're like, well, 80 negative comments versus, you know, 400 likes. I think that means the majority of people actually, you know, thought that there was some truth to it. So it's hard to kind of develop that filter of, you know, having that thick skin, but I think over time it's something that does become easier.
Right. I agree. But you see, Ivy, you've seen a lot of like really big accounts. They read the comments too much and they take the negative comments to heart. And I think an important point is if someone I respect calls me out and says, this was a dumb thing to say, that's right. One thing. But if someone I don't know, an anonymous account on the internet, leaves a nasty comment, I don't care. Like, I don't know them. They don't know me. They're just like sort of straw manning whatever I said. They don't actually understand. So really, totally. You know, if those who mind don't matter and those who matter don't mind is sort of a philosophy I think about.
Yeah. And Joe Rogan mentioned that on his podcast. I can't remember who was on, but it was a great point of how, I think it was with Jordan Peterson actually. And Jordan was saying, you know, how he was getting all of these negative comments and he didn't cry that time, but I'm sure he was crying because I saw your recent tweet. But Joe was like, well, why are you reading them? And Joe just so blatantly said, yeah, I never read the comments. And it's so much easier said than done to just not read the comments. Obviously, at his level, he can sustain it. So I think when you're a bit smaller, it's good to kind of engage with the community. So I think that's important. But there is something to be said of like, just disregard what other people think and just say and do what it is that you actually want to do.
I 100% agree. And yeah, especially at Joe's size, you cannot read the comments. There's just like
too much. No, exactly.
There's certainly value when you're a smaller, medium-sized account interacting with your audience. I think that's really important. On this idea, you put out a video, it's called The Billion Dollar Empire of Ben Shapiro. And I don't really personally care for Ben Shapiro. I liked his content when I was a little bit younger, but he grew his audience that way, right? He was authentic. He said things that at the time was pushing the envelope, and he was able to build this, you know, now probably billion-dollar company, The Daily Wire, that is against like a lot of the mainstream media talking points. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Like, how do you think about that? And then as it pertains to like alternate media, YouTube, these different outlets, because they're basically trying to become a Netflix competitor at this point, which if you'd have said that, you know, 3-4 years ago, people would have laughed you out of the room, but it seems like a legitimate possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that video was an interesting one to make because Ben is a controversial person. And I think he deserves a lot of credit. And everyone at the Daily Wire, like Candace Owens, Matt Walsh as well, whether you agree with them or not, there's something to be said about saying what you think, you know, and Ben doesn't shy away from that. You know, they're the opposite of vanilla. You're going to get a reaction from people. Either they'll agree with you or they will vehemently disagree with you. But that's where the value is. And it takes a special person to say, this is what I think, and I'm going to put it out there. And so in terms of his business, it's the Daily Wire is interesting because like you said, they are becoming a competitor to Netflix. I think there's a lot of people out there that are just fed up with the mainstream narrative, both with media companies or news outlets and Netflix. You know, Netflix has put out a bunch of woke content. Disney has been putting out a bunch of woke content. That's a video that I'm working on now. How Disney is just, you know, completely collapsing. Everything that's been going on with their recent movies that have flopped and then the Snow White thing that's going on. Mm-hmm. It's just crazy that these companies that are so big just are so out of touch with reality. Like, it's so infuriating because, you know, the average person, they want to bring their family to the movies. They want to be entertained and they don't want to receive this political speech. And they don't want these crazy things being told to their kids either. So you know how I feel about that, but I think there's an incredible opportunity in media now for alternative sources. So, you know, to build the next Netflix, I think is an incredibly difficult thing. And I'm curious to see how far a company can go while being branded conservative, right? The Daily Wire, they are openly conservative, which is great, but I wonder how much that can grow while still having that title of being conservative, versus saying, you know, a company that just won't talk about politics, or a media company that won't, you know, put a political indoctrination in their films or their shows or whatever it is. But yeah, The Daily Wire is a very interesting company.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I actually think this is their reasoning, because they basically made like Bent Key, I think it's like the subsidiary or whatever, because they don't want it to have any like branding association with The Daily Wire. And
okay,
I think objectively they want to create like just non-political, family-friendly content. We'll see obviously how far they can sustain that, because I think anytime you're telling a story, there's going to be some sort of bias. There's going to be some sort of narrative to get in there. But I also think it's interesting because a lot of these timeless tales, like you mentioned, Snow White, and there's just like universal stories, right? You have like the hero's journey and stuff like that. That's the way the culture has shifted. That is like viewed as conservative, like masculine men and feminine women. But really, right, that's just sort of like human nature at that point. I wouldn't necessarily say that's like a political ideology.
Yeah, things have been so skewed that we now view something as, you know, so simple, like a man providing for his family, as being, you know, so masculine or toxic masculinity. You know, it's gone so far. And so maybe on your point, maybe things like The Daily Wire, they don't need to be unbiased. Maybe it's good to just have alternatives, right? If you want to consume your, you know, liberal left-winging, you know, content, more power to you. These are the places to go. And if you don't agree with that and you want something else, then go this way. I think the problem is there's an unbalance right now, right? If you turn on the TV, the vast majority of media, news outlets, is going to be left-wing. You know, you have CNN, ABC, NBC, like, you know, you can go down the list. New York Times, I mentioned all these in the video, and or the video that, oh no, sorry, it was the Ben Shapiro video. They're huge. You know, New York Times, I think they're valued at like $8 billion, but there's no massive, aside from Fox News, which is even questionable now that Tucker's gone. You know, and I'm Canadian too, to mention. So, you know, it's, you know, I'm not watching Fox News or these outlets all the time. But yeah, I think there's definitely an imbalance, and it's time for, you know, that pendulum to swing a little bit.
Right. Definitely a lack of options there. Like kind of a side point, that I saw the Canadian guy. I really don't keep up with politics at all, but the dude eating the apple and like making those snarky comments.
I absolutely love him. Yeah. So he's Pierre Poilievre. So our prime minister right now is Trudeau, Justin Trudeau, who is just, he's a special human. And so Pierre is now the leader of the Conservative Party. So when there is the next election, he'll be the one running against Trudeau, or potentially someone else if Trudeau steps down, which a lot of Canadians do want to happen. But yeah, that was, for those watching that didn't see the clip, you have to watch it. You know, just eating the apple and roasting this reporter that was asking him questions. You know, you're taking a book out of Trump. Well, what do you mean? Can you be specific? And the reporter just couldn't answer any of his questions.
Yeah, that video was hilarious. And I saw some pretty good memes about it. On this point, and you mentioned Tucker, and he's brought his show to Twitter. I think it's called like Tucker on Twitter or whatever.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Twitter since Elon Musk has taken over? It's been about a year now.
Yeah, it has been a year. I think, you know, I wasn't super active on Twitter, or I didn't have much of a following on Twitter prior to Elon taking over. But it's nice to know that you can say something and it's not going to be taken down. I think that's incredible. I think there was a lot of not only censorship, but self-censorship. I think people were not putting things out that they wanted to say because they were afraid of getting banned or getting deleted or whatever it is. So I think as a whole, it's been a complete net positive. And I think it's incredible too that he fired 80% of employees and it still is running without a hitch. So I think overall it's been great. How have you found it since him taking over? Because I think you've been on Twitter a little bit longer.
Yeah, definitely better. I don't necessarily know that it's still like absolutely pro free speech. I think there's certain things you can't say, and that's fine if that's how he wants to run his platform. But he did sort of brand it as like anything goes, which I think that's how speech should be. But for the most part, it's still very good. There are concerns, especially among Bitcoiners, about the verification and what is he trying to build. Like, are you going to have to, like, are Anon accounts going to get banned? You have to give up your government ID. And I think there's also concerns, you know, he's mentioned he wants everything to be on X, even like payments and stuff. So that's
sounds like a lot of centralization.
Yeah, it's a little suspect, but as it is now, I think it's by far the most valuable social media, especially for me and anybody who's interested in Bitcoin.
Yeah, and I think the Bitcoin community often has an added level of skepticism, which I think serves it well. Sometimes I'm sure it doesn't, but somebody in the room has to, you know, be asking these larger questions of, you know, why is he doing this? Why is this happening? And so I think that's important.
Right. Yeah, that skepticism is definitely well amongst the Bitcoin community. I think obviously it's for the better net because it's sort of this like immune system response. If you get people trying to come in and change Bitcoin, like you want anytime someone suggests you change the Bitcoin protocol, the immediate knee-jerk reaction should be no, because this thing works. Let's not break it. And if we're going to make any changes, it needs to be like everyone's on board and it's a minor change and it's backwards compatible. So even if you don't want to change on your node, like you don't have to.
Totally.
Another one of your videos that I found really interesting was the 10 richest families in America. What did you learn from studying them? And I think a lot of people, they see wealthy families and they're like, they must have done something bad to get wealthy. They're evil rich. They exploited people, blah, blah, blah. How much of that is actually true?
Yeah. So that was a really interesting video to make. And I learned a lot about, you know, there's levels of wealth to this game and these families are just next level. It's hard to believe. One thing that I learned was that, you know, for the vast majority of the families, they're old money, right? These families go all the way back to the mid 1800s and, you know, they still have their wealth to this day. I think the most recent family is actually the top spot, which would be the Walton family with Walmart. I think the first Walmart opened in the 50s or 60s, I think 1962, I could be wrong on that. And so to me, that's kind of old money, but in the, you know, spectrum of the 10 families, they're the most recent. So that kind of taught me, you know, the value of thinking long term. You know, if you want to build this massive wealth, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a lot of time. In terms of ethics, there were several families on there that do or have done questionable things. One being, for example, the Cargill family. So, you know, they mass produce food. They basically have, you know, some kind of a part of their business is basically in every aspect of this food chain supply, which is probably pretty concerning. You know, they did poison a supply of wheat in, I think it was the 70s in Iran. A bunch of people died with, I think it was due to mercury. So there's definitely, I mean, you can look up Cargill and controversies. There's a long Wikipedia page of things that they've done. So that's definitely questionable. In terms of, there was other ones where the most interesting one that I found was the Hearst family. So they were number 9, I believe. And Hearst basically made modern day tabloids. This was back in the 1920s in New York City. You know, they were talking about all kinds of scandalous things, which, you know, even nowadays would be scandalous. But think the 1920s, you know, they were talking about sex on their newspapers, which you just don't do. And what was interesting about him was that he had tons of controversy around him. He was having an affair. He was going absolutely bankrupt to the point where his mistress needed to sell $1 million of her jewelry to pay his debts. He was a Nazi supporter. You know, he was, again, going completely bankrupt until World War II when the newspaper business picked up again. So that was a really interesting one. But to more, you know, neatly answer your question, I think there was certainly some questionable ethical things that these families have done. But there were others that simply, you know, haven't done things that are that questionable. For example, the Walton family, right? They employ, I think they're the number one private employer in the United States. I think 2.2 million people work for them. You know, that's changing a lot of lives, you know, mm-hmm. whether they should pay them $15 or not. You know, they are employing a ton of people, which I think is a positive. But yeah, it takes long-term thinking. And just one more thing I'll mention is that a lot of them were in the media business, which I found interesting. Hearst being one of them. There was a few others. One, I think it was the Koch family that now does the Black Book they own Auto Trader and they do the Black Book, but they started out by purchasing newspapers and then they started selling Black Book for cars. So it was kind of a building distribution and then selling, which is exactly what we still see today. But instead of purchasing newspapers, you can build your own media, Twitter, YouTube, whatever it is, and then sell a product. So that kind of timeless value of having media distribution still holds true to this day.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. And I think that's, there's like an action item people can take there from hearing that. And on your point about Walmart, yeah, they have provided a lot of value. It's a great product. It's a great store, right? I know I can go to Walmart and get anything I need for low cost. Totally. I think the key point here that, and I want to dive further into this, is that the wealth was built over generations, right? Despite, you know, the story of the prodigal son in the Bible, it's like a tale as old as time, delinquent kids that grow up wealthy, squandering the family wealth. How did these families manage to avoid that and actually pass on the wealth from generation to generation to generation?
Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I had dived deeper into how the wealth was passed over. But one thing that I did realize is that these families and their wealth and their businesses have gotten so large that they're no longer dependent on one person. So we're talking massive corporations. And so the decision-making really isn't in the hands of, you know, the son or daughter or whoever it is. So I think there's a lot of value in that and getting so large that you no longer have a singular point of failure. But it reminds me of a recent podcast I listened to with Patrick Bet-David, who said the story of how they were doing estate planning, of how they don't want their kids to, you know, destroy all of their hard work. How can wealth be passed down? How can it not be squandered? And he mentioned an interesting story of how, you know, you can hire estate planners. Some could be $10K, $20K, but others will be, you know, $100,000. And they'll literally sit down with your kids. They will interview your kids without you there. And they'll ask them questions. And then it's all recorded. They'll show it back to their kids. And, you know, they'll say X, Y, and Z reason why, you know, this kid shouldn't get money until, you know, they're 25 or it's got to be put in this trust. All that to say, I think it's a complicated question. I don't know if there's a common thing that these families have done. I need to look into that more. But you could look at I believe it's the Vanderbilts, who, you know, within two generations, it was all gone, which is just crazy. It's Anderson Cooper, I believe, is, I could be getting it wrong. I think it's the Vanderbilt family that he's a part of, where their entire, they had this huge family picture taken together several decades later, and there was not a single millionaire in the family.
Dang. Yeah, that's insane. I think, and I had this conversation with some people at a Bitcoin conference recently, because that's a question Bitcoiners are wrestling with, right? If Bitcoin does what we think it's going to do, we're going to have a lot of wealth. We need to pass it on to our kids in the right way. I think having the business and like a family business, and because like you said, there's not one single decision maker, it's more of an entity, an organization. The wealth is tied up in the business. You can't get one person to mess it all up. I think that's probably the ideal way to pass on wealth through generations. I think a key thing about Bitcoin, and you may not be familiar with this, is like the programmability of it. You can basically, you can time lock it. So it's like, you can't spend this Bitcoin until this day in the future, right? So the delinquent kid that shouldn't get his trust fund until age 26, you can actually program that in. So his Bitcoin won't be able to move until then, where the other kids, you could program it earlier.
That's insane. I had no idea that that was something that you could do. How difficult is it to program something like that?
I mean, I couldn't do it because I don't know how to code, but it doesn't seem like that hard. It's something that people are already able to do. And then there's also, there's like collaborative multi-sig basically. So for a Bitcoin wallet, you could have three keys. And let's say, Matt, you have one. Let's say you give one to your son and then you give one to a financial advisor. If you pass away, you know, you instruct your financial advisor, all right, like, don't give this kid the Bitcoin until he's 18 or whatever. And there's just so many different possibilities because of the fact that this is a digital money and we can code things in. We can use coding logic to sort of solve this problem of inheritance.
Absolutely. And I think Bitcoin actually changes the dynamic of preserving wealth dramatically, right? Before, with all these families, they needed to figure out a way, whether it was maintaining the business or what they're investing all of this excess cash in. With Bitcoin, completely changes it, right? It's finite. So if it's in Bitcoin, just leave it in Bitcoin. You don't need to buy, sell, you know, move it around. It's there, just leave it. And so I think we might actually see, maybe not in our lifetimes, but, you know, generations to come, you know, somebody that bought Bitcoin today, it's in the family, it stayed in the family for three generations, and the wealth is still there.
Yeah, I hope, I'm optimistic that's the case, especially with my offspring, because yeah, you don't need the family business, you don't need the family land, you just need to, like, this is the family Bitcoin, we're keeping this, like, don't ever lose it, don't sell it, don't lose it, don't get rid of it, nothing. And it reminds me, so like my family had, like it was probably my great grandfather, they had a bunch of land and property taxes got too high. They couldn't afford it. So they had to sell. I mean, that land's worth like a decent amount now, but it's not in the family. It's just problems like that, where with Bitcoin, that doesn't exist. There's no property tax. There's no maintenance. There's no running day-to-day operations. It's like, just hold it for decades and decades and you can pass it on to your family.
Do you find that as you stack more Bitcoin that you have gotten, not paranoid by any means, but more stressed in terms of making sure that it's safeguarded? Because I think most people, or I can just speak for myself, you start out with a little bit of Bitcoin. So, you know, you're not thinking about it too much. But as it continues to grow over time, you're like, well, I obviously have to, you know, get it off of Coinbase, you know, get into my own hardware wallet. So you do that, goes up a little bit more, stack a little bit more. You're like, I have a decent amount of money in here. Maybe I need to look into, you know, multi-sig vaults or whatever it is. Have you found that to be the case for your journey?
Absolutely. There's definitely, there was levels to it, right? After, you know, I had a little Bitcoin, it was very early in my journey. It was on the exchange. And then I realized that, oh, you don't actually own Bitcoin, but it's on the exchange. Took it off into a mobile wallet, got a little more, like price went up and I was like really dialing in on it. And I'm like, oh, so I need like a hardware wallet. And then the next thing you know, you get to multi-sig. So you can't take like someone who's never been in Bitcoin and jump immediately to multi-sig. I think there's steps and levels there, but certainly. And something that a lot of Bitcoiners talk about is you need to custody your Bitcoin and treat it in a way as if it's worth 10x more than it is, because it will be. Right. So if you lose a whole Bitcoin now, sure, it's only $37,000. That's a lot of money for a lot of people. But you're not just losing that $37,000, right? You're losing the entire opportunity cost of holding that Bitcoin. So if that Bitcoin's worth 1 million, you in the future, at least like you and I probably think it's going to be, then you need to treat it like it's worth 1 million now in terms of custody.
That's a great way of thinking about it. Thinking about that, it whatever you have now, it's 10x the value, right? Because if I'm saying, oh, you know, I'll put off the multi-sig vault, you know, if I say, well, if it's actually 10x the value, I need to call like somebody today, you know, right when this podcast ends, you know, I need to figure that out. That's a great way of thinking about it. And in terms of price, I'd be curious to get your thoughts. You know, when Bitcoin was under 30k, I was thinking, you know, this is a pretty good price. This is a very good price, you know, 25,000, 27,000. I was stacking. But now, as we're over 30, I'm a little bit more hesitant. And it's a very emotional decision, if not a very wise decision. Because if we say, well, this thing's going up, you know, forever, it's going up to 100K, 500K, a million eventually. Well, the difference between buying at 25 and buying at 35, it's pennies, right? So how have you found that to be similar for you, and how do you kind of adjust?
Yeah, I definitely agree with what you just said there. I mean, this fundamentally, because fiat has no bottom, Bitcoin has no top. And yeah, there's going to be ups and downs along the way. If you can buy the downs, that's great. But Michael Saylor has a quote that encapsulates it best. He's like, I'll be buying the top forever, which is exactly how I think about it, right? If you're dollar cost averaging and you're not spending money that you don't have, either with debt or you're putting next month's rent into Bitcoin, like that's not the way to do it. It's long-term savings, you know, however much you make, take a percentage of that every week, every other week, whenever you get paid into Bitcoin, leave it, forget it. If you're buying at 37, that's fine. That's still incredible value, in my opinion, especially in the next, you know, year or two. If we get this ETF, there's a lot of capital. There's $900 trillion in other assets that aren't Bitcoin. And that's going to get shuffled into over time. So definitely 37, you know, it might be a little emotional, right? Because you could have bought at 16 a year ago,
right?
But 37 is still very valuable. And we only have a few more minutes and I want to get to, so you've done a video on Michael Saylor, and I'm of the belief that he's going to be the wealthiest man in the world. Would you agree
100%.
With that?
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I don't know the cadence that he puts out these tweets, but when he says, you know, MicroStrategy has bought this amount of Bitcoin, you know, our average price is now this. I think now, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think now they're in profit. For a while, they were in a loss. But yeah, absolutely. The number of Bitcoin that he has is just insane. I do think he will be the richest person in the world, probably the richest person of all time, you know, eventually. I'll be curious to see what happens with the Bitcoin when he passes on. Obviously, it's under MicroStrategy, so the value of that business, you know, I don't know how it's impacted their day to day, right? Because they're not working with Bitcoin. They're just holding their cash in Bitcoin. So that'll be interesting to see. But do you think that there's a concern or an issue with somebody having that much? Because in a sense, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, the idea of decentralization, you know, of course he doesn't control the blockchain by any means, but it's a lot of coins in one wallet.
Yeah. So I think you hit the key point there, is that he doesn't control the blockchain. He doesn't control the protocol. It's not proof of stake. It's not the fiat system. Michael Saylor having MicroStrategy 150,000 Bitcoin, the only thing they can do is sell and like manipulate the US dollar price. But over time, there's psychopathic Bitcoin holders like me who will gradually buy up all that supply. So the worst thing he could do is make the price go down, which is nothing but like a short term, you know, bump in the road, so to speak.
Totally. And I think for smaller holders, you know, like myself, like, well, everyone's a small holder compared to Michael Saylor. I think it actually provides a lot of motivation, but also reassurance of saying, listen, we're in it together, right? If I lose a whole bunch of money, it is nothing compared to how much he is losing. And to see somebody have that level of conviction, I think for the whole Bitcoin community is really positive. And even going to the more micro level, just the average Joe that wants to purchase Bitcoin, that's a little bit stressed, that's a little bit apprehensive, I think it's phenomenal.
Right. That's a good framework to put it in. And I think especially for other corporations, they've seen how much value he's created for his shareholders. The MicroStrategy stock has just ripped since they've done the Bitcoin strategy. He's writing the playbook, right? And seeing him be so convicted, buying all the time, never stop stacking, it's really quite fascinating to see. And one more point I'll throw in there is, so they have the Bitcoin balance sheet strategy, and then they have their software business, but they actually have started to integrate Lightning a little bit. So they're offering like Bitcoin Lightning products. And I think he's got the whole team on board, right? I imagine the vibes, so to speak, are pretty good in the MicroStrategy group chats these days, especially the price going up. And
yeah, everyone's winning together, right?
Exactly. He had his whole board on the Bitcoin ship effectively. It's like, hey, this is what we're doing. If you don't like it, like, you can get out. So I think everyone there is probably in the same boat
100%.
Financially.
And I was just going to say, on top of that, they're one corporation, right? So think, if you get an Apple involved, you get a Facebook involved, you get any other, even not a corporation of their size, you get more corporations to do the same thing, the price will just absolutely explode.
Oh yeah, there's going to be 10, 20, 30 MicroStrategies in the next decade. I'll ask you, I ask this question to every guest before we wrap up. And I know you're into Bitcoin a little bit, but maybe not to the same degree as some of the past guests. What does Bitcoin mean to you, Matt?
That's a great question. Bitcoin to me, I want to give a good answer here. What does Bitcoin mean to me? I think Bitcoin to me offers an alternative path to freedom, a path that isn't the one that's been sold to all of us for the majority of our lives. Rather than working a job for 40 decades and losing your purchasing power over time, Bitcoin offers us an opportunity to make $1, put it in, and never lose the value of that dollar. And I think at the end of the day, that is freedom.
That was well said. It's the new American dream. It's the Bitcoin dream. It's 100%. Not the same thing. Where can we send the audience to find you and keep up with what you're doing?
So if anybody wants to watch any of the YouTube videos that I've mentioned, I'm trying to post, you know, once a week, but lately it's been, you know, two or three times a month. They can find my channel at Meet Matt L. They can find my Twitter as well, where I talk a lot about large funding that I'm building. And if you want any trading related stuff, you can find me on Twitter at Meet Matt L as well.
Thank you, Matt. I really appreciate you coming on.
Awesome. Thanks, Mitchell. I really appreciate it. This was a great chat.